Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, November 5th, 2021. I'm your reader, Christine. Today's weather will be mostly sunny and breezy, with winds out of the south 15 to 25 miles per hour. Cedar Rapids high of 55 and a low of 38. Iowa City high of 55 with a low of 39. Turning to the front page, an article entitled, Police, Fairfield Teens Murdered High School Teacher. This is written by Isabella Zaluski for the Gazette. The two plotted over social media to kill Nohima Graber, records say. Two Fairfield teenagers devised plans over social media to murder the Spanish class teacher at their high school, then struck her over the head and tried to conceal her body under a tarp at a park, according to court records filed Thursday. Willard Noble Chaden Miller and Jeremy Everett Goodale, both 16, each faced charges of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit a forcible felony. Each was being held on $1 million bail, the records show. Both boys will be tried as adults. They are accused of killing Nohima Graber, age 66, originally from Xalapa, Mexico, who had taught at Fairfield High School since 2012, though it was not disclosed whether she had been the teen's teachers. Before joining the Fairfield District, Graber had taught in the Ottumwa School District and graduated from Iowa Wesleyan in Mount Pleasant and received a master's in Spanish arts from the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Quote, an act like this is unspeakable and we are torn that one of our education family is a victim to such a senseless act, said a statement from Iowa State Education Association President Mike Baranek, who urged extra support and care for students in the Fairfield District, as well as for Graber's family and colleagues. Quote, every day educators work tirelessly to protect the students in their care. With full hearts and deep commitment, educators have been the backbone of our state and our nation during this unprecedented time. We cannot understand this or any violence aimed at such guardians, unquote. Family members had reported Graber missing on Wednesday morning. Investigators searched places she went often in the Jefferson County town of less than 10,000 people, including Chautauqua City Park, just blocks east of the high school, where she often walked. Records show she was seen there Tuesday afternoon. Authorities discovered her body there Wednesday, concealed under a tarp, wheelbarrow, and railroad ties, according to court documents. She had been hit on the head, but the documents do not say what caused the trauma. A murder investigation quickly led to Goodale and Miller. Fairfield Police interviewed an associate of the teens who provided investigators with social media exchanges indicative of Goodale having specific details of the disappearance and subsequent death of Graber, a criminal complaint shows. The details included, but were not limited to, the motive for killing Graber, the planning and execution of the means to kill Graber, as well as deliberate attempts to conceal the crime. The complaint states that the associate also shared social media postings indicating Miller was present for the murder. Police did not disclose details of the social media exchanges, including what they said about a motive. Acting on search warrants, authorities say they also collected several clothing items from Goodale and Miller that appeared to contain blood. Investigators said they also talked with a witness who saw the two teens at the park on Tuesday afternoon. Police confronted Miller in an interview. Quote, Miller admitted to being in Chautauqua City Park as the murder was taking place. unquote, a criminal complaint states, quote, providing materials utilized in committing the murder and aiding in actions taken to conceal the murder, unquote. A state public defender was appointed to represent Goodale. Miller did not request a court-appointed lawyer. A preliminary hearing is scheduled for 11 a.m. November 12th for Miller and at 11:30 a.m. the same day for Goodale at the Jefferson County Courthouse. Fairfield High dismissed classes at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, but kept the building open to staff and students who wanted to meet with support personnel. The Fairfield Community School District will not be in session today, the district said in a news release, but the high school building will be open for staff and students who want to meet with counselors and pastors. At 11 a.m., Graber's friends met at Central Park to pray for her. Quote, law enforcement would like to thank the public for their tips and concern following the announcement of Graber's disappearance, officials said in a news release. Law enforcement does not believe there is an ongoing risk to the public, unquote. The lead article on the front page is First COVID-19 Shots Administered to Children. CDC gave the go-ahead Tuesday for ages 5 to 11. This is written by Michaela Ram for the Gazette. With the first COVID-19 shot received, Ellen Pennell said she's most excited about the bragging rights. Quote, I'll pretty much be the first kid in my class to even get one, and the first one on the street that's under 12, unquote, Ellen said. The 8-year-old from Iowa City was among the first children in the corridor to receive a dose of the COVID-19 vaccine after federal health officials approved the Pfizer BioNTech for children ages 5 to 11 years old. Following the go-ahead from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Tuesday evening, pediatrics clinics, pharmacies, and other vaccine providers across the state began administering the first shots of the two-dose vaccine to young Iowans. Ellen was among a handful of appointments Wednesday evening at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital Pediatrics Clinic in Cedar Rapids. The choice to vaccinate her children against the coronavirus was an easy one for Ellen's mother, Jessica Pennell. Quote, I trust the scientists and I trust the CDC, said Jessica Pennell, 44, of Iowa City. I understand with every medical procedure there can be a rare chance of complications. I know that about all vaccinations, but the risks to the community outweigh the very minute risks that she could face getting vaccinated, unquote. To local health officials, the new phase of the vaccine distribution plan marked a monumental day in the effort to control community transmission of the coronavirus. Quote, vaccinating this age range checks a lot of boxes for us to help protect the kids, their families, and community, and to maintain the integrity of all of our systems that help support our communities, too. Unquote. University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics Chief Pharmacy Officer Mike Brownlee said, so I'm pretty excited, and I think a lot of us are, to have a safe and effective vaccine for kids that are in this age range, unquote. Many of the vaccinations happening over the next week or so will be among those early adopters who are eager to immunize their children against COVID-19, UIHC's Brownlee said. UIHC opened more than 1,500 vaccine appointment times for children aged 5 to 11 on Wednesday morning, and they were filled within an hour and a half, Brownlee said. Over the next week, UIHC will administer shots to about 200 children a day on weekday evenings and about 350 children on Saturday at its Iowa River Landing location. Appointments also are being offered at the Cedar Rapids Pediatric Clinic locations. By next Thursday, UIHC will transition to offering the vaccine during normal clinic hours, Brownlee said they opted to forego the evening large-scale clinics because officials expect the demand to taper off after about a week. We did large clinics for the 12 and up age group, and after about a week, the interest level and the patient volume really tailed off, he said. UIHC will offer vaccine clinics for the second dose, he said. Among the first parents in line to vaccinate their children at the UIHC clinic were healthcare workers, Brownlee said. They want their families, their homes to be protected, he said. They want their kids to be protected. They want to be able to come in to work and help patients. UIHC officials plan to open more vaccine appointments at other locations, including in North Liberty and its facility on Scott Boulevard, in the coming days. Other vaccine providers have begun offering appointments this week, but on a limited basis. The Hy-Vee retail chain announced the vaccine would be offered to children 5 to 11 years old at select pharmacies due to a limited supply this week. Appointments can be scheduled online at Hy-Vee.com/COVID vaccine, all one word. Other local health care providers will open up appointment slots later this week. The Mercy Vaccine Clinic at 5264 Council Street Northeast, Cedar Rapids, will start giving shots to children today between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. Online scheduling is open for appointments Monday through Friday at mercycare.org/COVID vaccine. Patients at Mercy Pediatric Clinic also can begin scheduling appointments on Friday by calling the office at 319-861-7900. All Unity Point Clinic Family Medicine and Pediatric offices will offer COVID-19 vaccines to children ages 5 to 11 in the coming days, officials said. Parents and guardians will be notified by email and through the My Unity Point system when appointments are available. For some families, vaccinating children is an important step to protecting themselves and others from serious illness and hospitalization. Lindsay Jasper of Marion said both she and her husband have an autoimmune disorder that puts them at risk from a COVID-19 infection. Their daughter, 6-year-old Hadley Jasper, received her first COVID-19 shot Wednesday evening at the UI Pediatrics Clinic in Cedar Rapids. Quote, "Now that we're vaccinated, it's giving us more freedom, more comfort to be able to go out and do things," unquote, said Jasper, age 38. To Hadley, getting the shot meant she could help keep everybody safe, she said. But she's also excited to reach a time where she doesn't have to wear a mask. Lindsay Jasper and Vax said vaccinating her daughter also meant she was protected from a COVID-19 infection as she continues going to school in person and participating in dance classes and other activities. "I just want her to be protected as soon as possible," she said. "We've been waiting for this. As soon as I found out appointments were available Wednesday morning, I wanted to get her in." To kids such as Ellen Pinnell, whose everyday lives have been upended for more than a year and a half, the vaccines are a step closer to things returning to normal. She's looking. "I just think the pandemic is really scary for kids," Pinnell said. "I've had to talk to my kids about things that I never thought I would have to, about people dying. But at the same time, it's been a really good opportunity to teach our kids about their responsibility." The next top story is by Kara Smith for the Quad City Times. UAW says, "Dear, didn't tell union that latest offer would be last one. Continuing strike could mean possible impasse. Are Dear and company and the UAW union at an impasse in labor negotiations? It depends on who you ask. Dear said Wednesday its latest contract offer, rejected by union members Tuesday, is the company's last, best, and final offer. Jen Hartman, a spokesperson for Dear, said Wednesday the company was proud of the 6-year contract offer, which would have boosted pay and benefits for about 10,000 UAW workers in 5 states. The UAW rejected the deal, 55% to 45%, despite gaining majority support from some Quad City locals. The contract was rejected by locals in Waterloo and Dubuque. UAW officials said Deere did not inform them the contract was its final and best offer before alerting the media. When asked about the notification of the final offer to the UAW, Hartman said both sides made concessions and compromises during contract negotiations. Quote, "In reaching the second tentative agreement with the union's bargaining committee, we advised that the overall value of the compensation and benefits package were as far as we were willing to go," unquote, she said. Labor experts say an impasse is difficult to define because it depends on the parties involved. Quote, "It's just at a point where both sides have given their best, last and final best offer," said Matt Pappas, an employment lawyer in Rock Island, Illinois. "You know it when you see it," unquote. The National Labor Relations Board requires an employer and unions to negotiate until they agree on a labor contract or reach a standoff or impasse. An impasse is defined as a total breakdown of the bargaining process that occurs after good faith negotiations and exhausted perspectives, according to the NLRB. Quote, "The duty to bargain isn't terminated, though," Pappas said. "It's only suspended," unquote. There is no formal process for determining or declaring an impasse, according to Paul Iverson with the University of Iowa's Labor Center. Both parties have to be unwilling to make any additional offers, but if one party creates a new proposal, the other party is obligated to hear it. Quote, "If all they're doing at the table is trying to convince the UAW to submit this same proposal to another vote, you may be at an impasse while still being at the table," Iverson said. "The issue is either side willing to change their position at the bargaining table?" Unquote. Hartman confirmed that Deere and the UAW still are communicating. Quote, "We are still in conversations with the UAW and remain receptive to any proposals the UAW might make that will result in a ratified contract, but we have reached our maximum in terms of overall new costs," unquote, Hartman said. Iverson and Pappas said the terminology used by Deere, last, best, and final offer, is a term of art in negotiations. This term typically indicates that a company has reached an impasse, according to Iverson. However, not all employers know the origin of the terminology and the full extent of what it means to use it, he said. Quote, "Sometimes employers will use the terminology, this is our last best offer and final offer, as a precursor to arguing toward impasse if the union doesn't accept that offer," Iverson said. "But those words aren't magic. They don't create an impasse if one doesn't exist," unquote. If an impasse is reached, Deere can implement the new agreement and fill union members' jobs with side workers, according to Pappas. Quote, "If negotiations reach an impasse, an employer can impose terms and conditions so long as it offered them to the union before impasse was reached," unquote, according to the NLRB. If Deere decides to implement the latest agreement, it would apply only to workers who are strike breakers, according to Iverson. If Deere unilaterally implements the latest tentative agreement and the UAW doesn't agree with the impasse, the union can file an unfair labor practice charge with the NLRB if they think violations have been made, according to Iverson. Quote, "That's how the National Labor Relations Board ultimately decides whether they're at an impasse," Iverson said. "If they decide, no, you're not at an impasse, you can't implement those terms. You have to go back to the table, unquote. Iverson said that if the UAW found out the proposed contract was Deere's final offer through the media, it could potentially qualify as bad faith bargaining depending on the circumstances. Deere's Hartman said, although Deere's first priority is to get an agreement ratified, the company needs to start preparing for the future, and everything was on the table. Quote, I do believe we have to start thinking longer term if that doesn't happen, looking at each unit and what their needs are, unquote, she said. Turning to the Insight page, we have the Gazette's editorial entitled, A Small Win for Transparency. As many Iowa politicos were staying up past their bedtimes tracking local election results on Tuesday, Johnson County observers might have been tucked soundly in bed. Almost all their races had full unofficial results posted within half an hour of the polls closing at 8 p.m. It's a credit to election workers, a small but important way to keep citizens engaged with the democratic process. Easy and prompt access to public information helps instill trust in local government. The Johnson County Auditor's Office is one of the best at this. Auditor Travis Weipert's staff recently completed restoring its historical election archives to the county website, a huge asset to journalists and the public. Decades of local voter data was taken down earlier this year as part of a website redesign, supposedly pursuant to Americans with Disabilities Act compliance. It struck us as absurd to offer less information in the name of accessibility. The Gazette wrote a letter to county officials urging them to keep the full set of records available. The Johnson County Election Archives, now once again available at johnsoncountyiowa.gov, are the most extensive in the state. They include state and federal results from the 1970s through today, and some historical results dating back to 1896. It is a cache of valuable information not only for journalists seeking to provide historical context, but also for political activists, concerned citizens, students, and scholars. In what some are calling a post-truth political world, reliable information about government and politics is vital. In a vacuum of information, misinformation will fill in. This is part of a broader issue of government accessibility and transparency online. Anyone who has been following local government long enough has been through at least one website redesign. Information and functionality seemed to disappear, though often they've just been buried under some counterintuitive series of links. As local governments adapt to changing technology, they should be sure to keep access to public information at the forefront. Here is At Liberty by Adam Sullivan. Another winning night for drugs. Drugs keep racking up W's in the government war on drugs. After a historic winning night for drug reform on Election Day 2020, voters in a few more jurisdictions signed off on ballot measures to ease drug laws in this past week's off-year elections. Meanwhile, in Iowa, where the people have no ability to put issues on the ballot, drugs remain highly illegal. This past Tuesday in Detroit, voters approved a ballot initiative calling to decriminalize adult therapeutic use of entheogenic plants, which includes psychedelic drugs such as psilocybin mushrooms and ayahuasca, Marijuana Moment reported. A growing number of cities and states are working toward lifting restrictions on hallucinogenic drugs that have potentially powerful mental health benefits and carry a lower risk of physical harm than many other substances. In Philadelphia, voters passed a referendum to demand marijuana legalization from the state government. While the ballot measure is non-binding, it could put pressure on policymakers in Pennsylvania, which now stands with Texas as the most populous states still criminalizing marijuana. In Colorado, where recreational marijuana has been legal for almost a decade under a voter-approved constitutional amendment, voters defeated a ballot item that would have hiked taxes on marijuana. It's an encouraging signal that marijuana freedom is important for its own merits, not just as a scheme to generate state revenue. And marijuana went 0.500 in Ohio, where voters in some cities approved local ballot issues to decriminalize marijuana while others rejected them. That's a helpful reminder to cautious Iowa policymakers that drug policy is not all or nothing. They could give local governments the authority to set their own enforcement priorities. Many Iowans understandably get ballot envy looking at these pro-drug election results from elsewhere. Why can't we have nice things like those other states have? Citizens in about half the states have the ability to petition for issues to be put up for a vote. Many states, including Iowa's neighboring South Dakota, Nebraska, and Missouri, give their people broad authority to directly influence state law. Voters there can petition to make constitutional amendments, codify new laws, and strike down existing ones. Iowa has no such process. The only way for voters to directly weigh in on state policy is for lawmakers to propose a constitutional amendment, a lengthy and politically challenging process that requires at least 2 years of legislative work, leading to a statewide vote. There are signs that the GOP resistance to pot is weakening. This year in the legislature, a Republican-controlled committee advanced a bill to reduce first-time marijuana possession to a simple misdemeanor, which could allow local governments to further reduce penalties. The bill never saw floor votes in either chamber. Public opinion is moving strongly in favor of freedom. Gallup poll data out this week shows more than two-thirds of the Americans support legal marijuana, including 50% of Republicans. The question now in Iowa is which is more durable, Republicans' legislative majorities or their opposition to drug reform? Today we have one community letter. It is submitted by Bill Bergman, Director of Research, Truth in Accounting, Chicago. We appreciate State Senators Pam Jochim and Joe Bolcom citing Truth in Accounting's financial analysis of Iowa's state government in their recent op-ed titled "Federal Bucks Boost Iowa's Budget" of November 2nd. But their op-ed overstates our appraisal of the contribution of federal funding to Iowa's government finances. We noted that Iowa was financially sound before the pandemic. In fact, we also had Iowa ranked 10th in the 50 states in our analysis last year, before the pandemic arrived. Iowa has had a relatively stellar record of keeping accrual expenses in line with or below revenue, in contrast to many states in the nation, including our own Illinois. This fiscal discipline swamps federal government grants in explaining the good example Iowa's government sets for many states. It also bears underlining that our assessment is of Iowa's government financial condition, not the strength of Iowa's economy, as implied by Senators Jochim and Bolcom. A state's economy and its government are two very different things. Many participants in Iowa's economy pay taxes to a local, state, and federal government, and federal government grants for state government programs have mixed, if not ominous, implications for Iowa taxpayers. Again, this was submitted by Bill Bergman, Director of Research, at Truth in Accounting, located in Chicago. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, November 5th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Jeffrey Allen, quote, Sarge, unquote, Sergeant of Strawberry Point, age 67, passed away on Wednesday, November 3rd, at his home. He was born on July 9th, 1954, in Manchester, the son of James and Dorothy Sargent. Jeff was raised and educated in Strawberry Point and was a 1972 graduate of Starmont High School. Funeral service is at 2 p.m. Saturday, November 6th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Strawberry Point, with Pastor Susan Friedrich officiating. Visitation is from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, November 6th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Strawberry Point. Lawrence Eugene, quote, Bud, unquote, Cool, K-U-E-H-L, age 88, of Edgewood, passed away on Thursday, November 4th, at the Gutenberg Municipal Hospital in Gutenberg, Iowa. Survivors include his wife of 68 years, Betty of Edgewood, and his 8 children. Because of COVID-19, masks are recommended at the funeral home and at the church. Funeral service with military rites, 10:30 a.m., Tuesday, November 9th, at Hope Lutheran Church in Littleport, with the Reverend Margaret Yackel-Julien officiating. Visitation is from 2 to 7 p.m., Monday, November 8th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Edgewood. Internment will be at the Cass Township Cemetery, Strawberry Point. Audrey Lone died Saturday, October 30th, at the age of 90. Visitation will be held 10 a.m. Tuesday, November 9th, at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, 8300 C Avenue in Marion, preceding the service. Audrey's funeral service, officiated by Pastor Steve Qualbin, will follow the visitation at 11 a.m. A light lunch will be served after worship. Audrey's remains will be laid to rest at Oakland Cemetery in Solon. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials in Audrey's name to be directed to St. Mark's Lutheran Church. Carol L. Wagner Clark, age 82, of Mount Vernon, passed away Tuesday, November 2nd, following a recent illness. Private family funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 8th. Burial will be at Mount Vernon Cemetery. Friends and extended family are invited to join Carol's service via webcast. To find the webcast link and to share your support and memories with Carol's family, visit her tribute wall at www.stuartbader.com under obituaries. Carol was a social, friendly, supportive, and caring woman. Her family will always be grateful for her unending love and support. Sharon Byers Miller, age 77, of North Liberty, passed away peacefully on October 14th at Keystone Place at Forever Green. She was a teacher and a librarian in Cedar Rapids for over 32 years. There are no services planned at this time. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the American Cancer Society. Harold Lee, age 96, of Webster, passed peacefully into the loving arms of Jesus on November 2nd at Mercy Hospital, Iowa City. No services are planned. He was drafted into the U.S. Army and served 2 years in Kyoto, Japan, as a waiter in the officers' mess hall. When he returned from Japan, he married Evelyn Hubbs. Together, they raised their family and farm near Webster. He didn't farm to make a living. He lived to farm. Later in life, he experimented with different types of agriculture, including growing fruit trees, raising ostriches, raising koi fish, and winemaking. He planted walnut trees and 2 chestnut trees, which were his pride and joy. Linda L. Stone King, age 77, of Springville, died Wednesday, November 3rd, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy, Hiawatha. Private graveside service will be at Mount Vernon Cemetery. Arrangements by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services of Mount Vernon. Linda enjoyed horseback riding, working on crosswords with her twin sister Laura, traveling to Colorado to visit family, writing poetry, and was a damn good shot. She could split a match with a .22 rifle. Linda had a strong work ethic and worked diligently as a secretary in shipping for Rockwell Collins for over 30 years, retiring in 1993. Linda was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis around that time. Betty Jane Prindle Ball, B-O-L-L, age 91, of Lewisburg, Kentucky, passed away on Tuesday, November 2nd, in Russellville, Kentucky. She and her husband brought up their family on the Ball family farm in Dundee, Iowa, before spending many years living in the mountains of North Carolina. They eventually resettled in Logan County, Kentucky, where they grew plentiful, beautiful vegetable gardens and cared for many appreciative cats. A memorial service for Betty will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, November 8th at Our Savior Lutheran Church in Manchester, Iowa, with Pastor David Weber officiating. Interment alongside her husband will follow at Forestville Cemetery in Dundee, Iowa, at a later date. In other notices, in Blairstown, Mary Jane Fisher, age 86, died Wednesday, November 3rd. In Cedar Rapids, Earl Liebert Fry, age 88, died Thursday, November 4th. In Cedar Rapids, Norma June Fry, 86, died Wednesday, November 3rd. In Cedar Rapids, Nancy Hummel, age 84, died Thursday, November 4th. In Edgewood, Carolyn Newhouse, age 73, formerly of Manchester, died Tuesday, November 2nd. In Garnavillo, Annette H. Matt, age 89, formerly of Midlothian, Illinois, died Friday, October 29th. In Marion, Stephen William O'Neill, age 72, died Friday, October 29th. In Marion, Sandra D. Tate, age 57, died Wednesday, November 3rd. In North Liberty, Richard, otherwise known as Rich, W. Newkirk, age 35, died Wednesday, November 3rd. In Vinton, Helen North Bruce, age 100, died Tuesday, November 2nd. In Vinton, Nancy L. Stainbrook, age 76, died Wednesday, November 3rd. Now, turning to sports, here are some sidelines. Iowa fires head volleyball coach, Brown. The University of Iowa fired head volleyball coach Vicki Brown, athletics director Gary Barta announced Thursday. Brown had a 17-56 record in less than 3 seasons at the helm, including a 9-43 record in Big Ten play. Brown took over as head coach in 2019 after Iowa fired former coach Bond Szymanski for giving an impermissible benefit to an athlete. She was previously the associate head coach on Szymanski's staff. Iowa still has another 8 matches left in 2021. Iowa assistants Dave Brown and William Tatke will lead the program on an interim basis, according to the news release. This was written by John Stepp for the Gazette. Big Ten soccer. Rutgers ousts Iowa in tourney semifinals. Piscataway, New Jersey. The fifth-seeded Iowa soccer team, 12-6-2, fell 2-0 to top-seeded Rutgers, 17-2, on Thursday in the Big Ten tournament semifinals at Yorkac Field. The loss was just Iowa's second defeat in its last 8 postseason games dating back to last season. Iowa wrestling. Season tickets sold out for Hawkeyes season. Iowa City. The Iowa Athletics Department announced Thursday that season tickets for the 2021-22 Hawkeye wrestling season are sold out. Home duels against Minnesota and Penn State are also sold out. A limited number of single tickets for home duels against Princeton, Oregon State, Purdue, and Wisconsin may become available for public purchase the week leading up to each home event. College football. Shudak Mebus still in running for Groza Award. Iowa's Caleb Shudak and Iowa State's Andrew Mebus were named 2 of 20 semifinalists for the Lou Groza Collegiate Place Kicker Award presented by the Orange Bowl. 3 finalists will be announced November 23rd, with the winner announced live on ESPN at the Home Depot College Football Awards show on December 9th. Iowa football. Hawkeye huddle set for Evanston, Iowa City. Hawkeye fans following the Iowa football team to Evanston for the Hawkeyes' game against Northwestern are encouraged to attend the Hawkeye huddle tonight. Fans are invited to join the National I Club from 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. at Leader Bar, 3000 West Irving Park Road in Chicago, north of downtown. Here's an article on college football written by Jeff Johnson for the Gazette. Bergen goes from walk-on to nation's leading tackler. Northwestern linebacker piling up stats in fifth season. Iowa City. Chris Bergen was in no mood post-game last Saturday to discuss his rather heroic performance. None. The Northwestern linebacker had 19 tackles against Minnesota, a career high, coming 1 week after setting a career high with 16 stops against Michigan. That's doing some serious work. But both of those games were lopsided losses. Honestly, it means nothing if we don't win, Bergen said. I'd trade every tackle in the world to win. I've been in the program. We've won 3 of my 4 years here. There's no feeling like it, and I'd do anything to get that feeling back, including making 0 tackles if that's what it would take. Unquote. This has not been a good season for Northwestern, which takes a 3-5 record into its Saturday night game at home against Iowa. The Wildcats have lost 3 of their last 4 games, being outscored by Nebraska, Michigan, and Minnesota in those games by a combined margin of 130-28. Northwestern must win 3 of its final 4 to become bowl eligible. For Bergen, that is the emphasis, not his individual performance. quote, "It's just a decision we've got to make as a team, as a whole, as individuals," he said, "to choose not to get blocked, to choose to be violent. It's nothing our coaches can do for us. It's a decision you've got to make as a grown man when you go on the field and someone is trying to take what you've got. You either get got or you get yours. We've got to get ours. Be violent, physically execute. It's on me as a leader to get this defense ready. I failed at that, so I'm going to do a reflection. I've got to get better, see where I can help this team get better, go from there," unquote. The graduate student is a great story, a former walk-on turned team captain who leads the Big Ten Conference in tackles by a large margin, who is tied for the lead nationally in tackles per game. He was considered too small physically coming out of Detroit's Country Day High School, where he was a safety and running back. But the cliche about not being able to measure heart applies here. Bergen was a special teams specialist as a true freshman in 2017 and ascended to a starting linebacker spot in 2018. He set a career high with 12 tackles in Northwestern's 21-20 win last season over Iowa, but that's been nothing compared to his production this season, in which he took advantage of the NCAA ruling allowing players another year of eligibility because of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. Bergen has 98 tackles in 8 games, 60 of them solo. The average of 12.2 tackles per game is tied for tops in the country, the average of 7.5 solo stops per game flat out leading the country. Quote, "He's a guy who is relentless in his work ethic," said Northwestern coach Pat Fitzgerald. "You've got to be a pro at this level at taking care of your body, and he does an unbelievable job at that. The unrequired work, he is a guy who is willing to put in 20 hours a week with the guys. It takes a lot of unrequired work, a lot of voluntary time to be the best he can possibly be and to take teammates along with you," unquote. Bergen's father, Joe, was a starting defensive lineman for Michigan State's 1988 Rose Bowl team. His brothers Owen and Joe Jr. previously played at Northwestern. This is a football family. Quote, "I think it comes down to one simple phrase that was taught to me by my dad, told repetitively. Then my visit to Northwestern, I heard Coach Fitz say it verbatim, word for word," Bergen said. "It was at that moment that I knew this place was going to be home. Work hard, keep your mouth shut, and good things will happen. I think that's kind of been my mentality," unquote. State Volleyball Class 3A Championship, Achieving the Dream. West Delaware slows West Liberty star just enough, gets 3A crown. This is by Jeff Linder for the Gazette. Cedar Rapids. Reach for the stars? Sure. But first, the West Delaware Hawks had another target. Quote, "Coach Brett Mather told our outside hitters to reach for the pin," unquote, Olivia Schulte said. The second-ranked Hawks slowed Macy Dofelt just a bit and downed number 4 West Liberty in 4 sets. For the Class A State Volleyball Championship, Friday. Afternoon at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. Quote, "A lot of emotions right now," Hawks setter Carly Smith said. "This was our redemption year for sure. We came back with loads of experience and we got to get what we really wanted," unquote. Now turning to the business section. Alliant ISU to develop solar farm. The utility will operate the facility. Alliant Energy and Iowa State University said Thursday they plan to build a solar farm on university land south of Ames. Madison, Wisconsin-based Alliant will design, construct, own, operate, and maintain the solar farm. The State Board of Regents approved the request. "This new collaboration is the latest in our long-standing partnership with Alliant Energy to prepare our communities, state, and nation for the future of energy and power," Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein said. referring to a five-year strategic plan for sustainability in operations announced in 2020. Quote, the public-private partnership represented in the new solar farm will be a significant step in making progress on our mutual renewable energy and sustainability goals, unquote. Earlier this week, the utility said it planned to file a proposal with the Iowa Utilities Board to buy a large-scale solar project near Palo from NextEra Energy in the site of the now decommissioned Duane Arnold Energy Center, with the aim of developing it into the state's largest solar and battery storage facility. The Ames Area Solar Farm is to be built on land that is part of ISU College of Agriculture and Life Sciences Animal Science Teaching and Research Farms. The up to 900 kilowatt solar farm at maximum output could power 230 houses a year and will provide an equal amount of electricity to nearby teaching and research farms, Alliance said in a news release. ISU will obtain renewable energy credits generated by the solar farm, which will offset a portion of the university's annual carbon emissions. Construction could begin in late 2022 or 2023, the release. In the Iowa Today section, there is a piece written by Vanessa Miller for the Gazette entitled, Woman Jailed, Accused of Faking a COVID Diagnosis. Boulder woman to be extradited from Johnson County Jail, Iowa City. A 41-year-old former immigration lawyer facing theft charges in Colorado is being held in the Johnson County Jail in Iowa City, accused of fabricating a positive COVID-19 test from the University of Iowa in an attempt to avoid a mandatory court appearance in Colorado. Emily Elizabeth Cohen was booked at 3:08 p.m. Tuesday on a detainer from the Boulder County Sheriff's Office shortly after she tweeted that the Colorado court system, quote, just had me arrested, alleging I lied about having COVID, tweeting from cop car, unquote. To that Twitter message, Cohen attached two pictures, one apparent screenshot of an electronic medical record showing a positive COVID-19 result, and another of an apparent medical excuse from the UI Hospitals and Clinic nurse practitioner Christina Nelson. The letter Cohen shared appears to show Nelson stating, Emily reports she was tested at Walgreens on 10/28/21 and states she was positive for COVID-19. Citing Iowa Public Health Department guidelines, the letter indicates Emily will need to remain at home until they have been fever-free for 24 hours without the use of fever-reducing medicine and other symptoms have improved and at least 10 days have passed since their symptoms first appeared. The tweeted letter notes Cohen's symptoms started October 24th. Cohen is scheduled for a 10-day trial in Boulder County in Colorado starting December 6th for 11 felony theft counts stemming from allegations she collected tens of thousands in fees from immigrant families before losing contact with them without producing visas or work permits, according to the Boulder Daily Camera newspaper. Boulder County prosecutors said Cohen also submitted letters from UIHC in July asserting she had COVID-19 symptoms, and then a district court judge issued an order requiring Cohen appear in person unless she's able to produce a positive test after she failed to appear for an in-person hearing claiming COVID-19, according to the Daily Camera. The publication reported Cohen on Monday produced another UIHC letter saying she had COVID-19 as an excuse for failing to appear in person for a pretrial conference Tuesday. She instead appeared virtually but dropped off the call. During that hearing, according to the newspaper, A Boulder County Deputy District Attorney said skeptical prosecutors checked with UIHC. The UI doctor cited in the letter that Cohen submitted denied writing it, calling it invalid, according to the Daily Camera. The newspaper quoted a Boulder County prosecutor as saying, quote, "It seems that we have evidence that Ms. Cohen has attempted to defraud the court," unquote. Cohen, during her virtual appearance Tuesday, apparently dropped off the call after prosecutors presented the UIHC letters. On Twitter, she wrote that she was kicked off the call and can't get back on it. Cohen said prosecutors were accusing her of lying because, according to her, the hospital said it was a resident cited in the letter. "This means I'm lying," she wrote. "Hospital says a resident is a doctor." Shannon Carbone, a spokeswoman for the Boulder County District Attorney's Office, confirmed for the Gazette the court issued a warrant for Cohen's failure to appear. Additionally, there is an ongoing investigation into the documents that she provided to the court, Carbone said. Details about why Cohen was in Iowa City have not been made public. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for November 5th, a Friday, 2021. I'm your reader, Christine. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.